Good morning. My name is Barry Levy. I'm affiliated with Tufts University School of Medicine. I'll be the moderator this morning. This is session 4058 on climate change and public health. This session is in memory of Barry Commoner, who is known to many of us, who's a botanist and biologist and a founder of the environmental movement. He believed that scientists have an obligation to share scientific information with the public to enable them to participate in debates on scientific issues. He worked on the effects of the fallout from the nuclear weapons testing, and which provided the scientific foundation for the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in 1963. Barry Commoner contributed in many other ways. He helped to establish the roots of the Blue-Green Alliance of labor union members and environmentalists. He showed the connections between the environmental crisis and socioeconomic issues such as poverty, social injustice, public health, and war, and the roots of the environmental crisis. He also demonstrated that the roots of the environmental crisis lay in excess corporate power and the flawed systems of production, and demonstrated that only by changing those systems could the root causes of environmental problems be eliminated. He wrote a number of things, including a book called Closed Circle in the early 1970s, which had his four laws of ecology, the first of which is everything is connected to everything else. In its obituary, the New York Times, in October 2012, the title of his obituary was Scientist, Candidate, and Planet Earth's Lifeguard, and it said in part, Dr. Commoner practiced what he preached. In his personal habits, he was as frugal as a Yankee farmer and as commonsensical. He drove or took taxis if the route by public transit took him too far out of the way. On the other hand, he saw no need to waste electricity by ironing his shirts. And when a New York Times writer once asked his Queens College office to mail some material, it arrived in an old brown envelope with a crossed-out return address of the Botany Department at Washington University, where he had last worked 19 years earlier. So it's with great honor that we're having the session in his memory. The first speaker is David Wegman, who is a professor emeritus in the Department of Work and Environment, University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and an adjunct professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. David was the founding chair of the Department of Work and Environment and the former dean of the University of Massachusetts Lowell School, founding dean of the School of Health and Environment. His occupational health research spans decades and more than 200 publications on respiratory disease, cancer risk, musculoskeletal disorders, as well as a number of aspects of surveillance. He's a national associate of the National Research Council and a member of its board on human systems integration and the Institute of Medicine Committee on Aerospace Medicine and Medicine of Extreme Environments. He'll be presenting on the topic heat stress intervention to prevent chronic kidney disease in El Salvador. David?
Okay. Thank you, Barry. Good morning. This topic that I'm presenting on is, let's see, first of all, I don't have any fine personal relationships. This topic I'm presenting on is not so much about the future of climate change, but really is what are climate effects today, we believe. At least that's where we've been going with this study. The background of my study is that chronic kidney disease of non-traditional origin, that means not due to diabetes or hypertension, has had a dramatic increase in the Pacific coast of Central America, pretty much up and down the line, primarily affecting adult males, particularly sugarcane workers, and with prevalence rates of approximately 14 to 34%, in that population, which is unheard of in terms of kidney disease in a general population, the mortality rates in the high incidence areas in El Salvador make it the most common cause of death in that working age males. This shows you some evidence of the trends over the last 15 years in Central America of chronic kidney disease. The top curve on the right is males, on the left is females. The top curve is El Salvador, the second one is Nicaragua, and then the others are further down. The flat line at the bottom of the males is includes Costa Rica, but let me show you what happens. Wait, what happened? There, Costa Rica. Where if you look in Guanacaste, which is one of the sugarcane sections of Costa Rica, the rates have gone up hugely compared to the national rates on the right. The current state of knowledge is evolving. We're meeting actually in Costa Rica in 2 weeks to update everybody on where we stand on this, both in Central America and globally. The leading hypothesis we're operating under is that it's repeated heat stress and dehydration due to strenuous work in hot environments. These folks are living in hot environments, so it's not that they aren't acclimatized to those, but they're added strenuous work at a level that is 6 months worth of running marathons. It's a huge, physically demanding job. Most of the victims, patients, are from sugarcane work, not exclusively, and there's no reason, if our hypothesis is correct, that it would be exclusively sugarcane. Sugarcane has the most concentrated high-intensity labor in hot periods of time, so it's a reasonable concentration to expect. Other hypotheses on the table that we think there's less good evidence when you compare the distribution of the risks to the distribution of the disease are pesticides or herbicides, heavy metals, hard water, leptospirosis, and the use of NSAIDs. If you put those together, there's probably some combination and relatively greater or lesser likelihood of the disease if the heat stress, dehydration, and strenuous work are combined with some of these other variables. The list of the other hypotheses are all known kidney toxins. It's just a question of how prevalent and how different male, female in this age group. So we've started an intervention study. We did the pilot, which I'm reporting on today. It's a two-year study. The first year we completed in the end of the harvest in April of 2015. We're starting another one the end of this month in El Salvador. We're working with Ingenio El Angel and its mill in El Salvador, a unique corporate entity in that this is a owner who believes in social justice and wants to find out what's going on and do something about it. They're sponsoring a fair amount of the costs of our intervention in addition to the research that we're doing, and that's remarkable and commendable. They have direct employees of the mill that operate at about 400 meters above sea level, and the cooperatives and contractors who sell their sugarcane product to the mill are operating pretty much at sea level. And throughout our study this past year, and even worse this coming year, is the security we need to carry out our research. The gang activity is intense. We need to go into the field with four armed guards for every day that we're in the field. It's one of the costs of doing research in this environment. The design of our study is prospective with four major sampling times, a baseline, which we will be collecting next week in El Salvador. Pre-intervention, which is before we introduce our intervention, I'll tell you in a moment when that is. In the first time, we waited 6 weeks before we introduce the intervention just because of the mechanics of getting it going, then mid-intervention, and then just at the end of the harvest before they close down. We have two groups, one at the high level, 400 meters, and one at the coast level. 87% of them were male, and they're all between the ages of 18 and 63 with a median at 39. The intervention components are water, rest and shade, and efficiency. The water is, they have always had and needed water. It's certainly needed in these environments. They just haven't had easy access to it. We've provided them with camelbacks and a refill supply in shade tents, which have been constructed by the company and are moved along with the cutting activity so that the shade is easily accessible, so that when they stop, they can stop in shade. And we have scheduled time rest breaks, which occur every hour and a half to an hour, depending on time of day, in which they come to these shade tents, rest for about 10 minutes, refill their camelbacks, and they also sharpen their machetes. Part of this, you can see, this is piecework. This is paid piecework, and as a result, the individuals will work continuously in order to make what is really an inadequate wage in Central America for all of these workers throughout the countries. So that we were concerned that they would not cooperate without some parallel attention to their income. The Ingenio agreed to pay for any difference on average between what they were usually making and what they would make if they kept taking these rest breaks. But we added an efficiency component where we changed the machete to a lighter and ergonomically more sound machete, and we changed the organization of the cutting so the individuals would be able to cut more efficiently and use less physical labor. We did data collection, blood, urine, and questionnaire at baseline and those three main survey points, and then every 2 weeks we did a pre-post shift urine sampling and questionnaire to try to track their response to heat, stress, and particularly to their kidney function. We did data collection on temperature and humidity, continuous daily WBGT measures, which are rather remarkable documentation of this work environment. And then in the efficiency characterization, the daily harvest per cutter was recorded. The stick is a coded stick indicating who did what in each day. The number of garrotters loaded, that's a grab from a mechanical loader, is the measure of productivity of the individual. And then the piece rate is per garrotter collected at the end of each day. In the population studied, we had 60 in the inland, somewhat elevated level 400, and at the coastland 60. The coastland group we lost effectively during the course of our study, weren't able to introduce the intervention because they were there was a communication breakdown, which we finally resolved over the course of the 6 months of the study so that they were willing to participate at the end, but we weren't able to do the intervention nor measure them around the intervention. As a result, they didn't get the intervention. They are eager to cooperate this year. This gives you an idea of how bad the temperature is. Across the bottom is the hours of the day. They start at sunrise around 5:30 or 6 in the morning. They end as late as 5 to 6 p.m. in the evening. On the coast, they end earlier. So the red bars are the coast, which ends around noontime, whereas in the higher lands, they work essentially a double shift and through the course of the day. The three horizontal lines are the OSHA recommended limits on work activity, the lowest being you work 75% of the time, 25% rest. At the top, it's 25% work, 75% rest. And they're exceeding that. They aren't doing the OSHA criteria. We're getting some rest time into them. But it gives you an idea of how extreme the environment is that they're working in over the course of the zafra, the harvest. Here's a numerical characterization of this. Only a third of the time inland and in the lowland, only 26% of the time are they working under a level WBGT exposure that does not require a scheduled rest periods. And 30% on the right-hand side, 38% of the time, almost 40% of the time in the lowland, they're working above the 25% work limit of OSHA's, and inland it's 10%. So it's a rather dramatic work environment. So you can see why we thought to focus on heat stress. We were impressed, though. We didn't have to do much in terms of salary replacement because the efficiency part of our intervention made a big difference. In fact, in the course of this study, the other cutting teams that we were serving the Ingenio were operating with a different efficiency expert. They didn't get new machetes. They did get a different pattern of work. And this group had the greatest increase in efficiency of any of the groups. They started using some of our techniques because they became so evidently positive in efficiency. And we believe, we're actually doing a study on work strain, we believe it's also less strain, not just higher efficiency. In terms of the one comparison, we have self-report of agrochemical use. During the harvest, there's essentially no agrochemical use, and that's one of the attributed causes of this in some environments. We don't believe it is. They do use them in other non-harvest times, so it's not as if they're absent from their lives. So we're still in the process of evaluating the results, but we did have results of the self-report on our questionnaire. Notably, there were less symptoms of dehydration of these following symptoms here, and the most remarkable thing was no cases of heat stroke, which they have every year had in the past. So clearly, we think our intervention for the heat stress was a positive. Whether it will have the long-term effects of affecting the kidney function or not, we're not sure about. These are very preliminary results on estimated glomerular filtration rate. The inland group across the top, we sampled it each time, and you can see that there was a drop between the baseline and the pre-intervention, and then it leveled out or increased slightly, so that it's at least suggestive that we're doing okay. We're not certain whether this drop occurs during the acclimatization period, the first week or two of the harvest, or whether it is a gradual change, but that's to be determined. And the coastline, you can see the effects are greater. They start at baseline at a lower level, and they basically lose across the course of the harvest without any intervention. So, as I said, we're planning to start in the end of this month. 120 workers in the higher elevations, 360 in the coastlands. This will be 8 different work groups. We've got a variety of national agencies involved in the work, and other countries have been participating. This is the group that I owe my thanks to and our thanks to, that include workers and staff from 4 different universities, 1 in England, 2 in Sweden, 1 in the U.S., an NGO. This whole thing is, I'll explain at another time, how this whole thing is funded by the Dutch postcode lottery. one positive aspects of gambling. Several consortia of occupational environmental health and safety folks in Central America, SALTRA and CENCAM, for those of you who know anything about this. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
We have time for 2 or 3 questions. Richard, Michael. Have you been aware of any presence of mold on the sugarcane or possible mold exposures? I'm raising this because ochre toxin, which is probably the most common of the toxins, is associated with fault and endemic pathology, and if it's there, maybe you contribute.
We have looked for that and have not found it. This is one of the characteristics of the cane here is that it's burned before cutting, so that pretty much biologicals are destroyed by that. And it's a short-term burn. The day before they burn, they go in. It's one of the consequences that there may still be heat in the ground from the burning. But this is burned cane.
Another question, please.
This was what we have right now, which is the estimated glomerular filtration rate, which suggested that we are having a positive impact. We are looking in more detail at a variety of parameters that are affected by effective kidney function that we're in the process of analyzing right now. We looked at this immediately just to see if there was evidence, but I think we do have a number of good parameters to follow.
In the back. Yeah, Craig.
I may have missed this, but so is there evidence that the fields are getting hotter because of global warming, or has production changed in a way that makes it so that they're working harder?
Why does this mystery come out of nowhere? Is that the question?
Yeah. Climate
yeah. Well, the APHA decided to put these together, but there is a connection, although not specifically documented. This epidemic began somewhere between 20 and 30 years ago. It's very difficult to say that it first came to light when the dialysis units in El Salvador were overwhelmed by cases. So that it became evident something was going on, and this led into some investigations. Why now with the sugarcane industry? It's grown tremendously in the last 40 years in Central America. It's really replaced cotton and other subsistence crops as the main source of agricultural product in the Pacific rim of the of Central America. So there's been an increasing work in this area. There's been increasing market for the sugar, which calls for increasing rates of production, which means that we think the workforce is working harder. It's certainly working hard in this environment. There is a suspicion on the part of one of the nephrologists in El Salvador that the problem has gotten worse because the temperature on average has increased something of the order of 1 to 2 degrees. Documenting that effectively and integrating that into this is uncertain, but global warming ain't help in this situation.
Time for one more question, right there in the back. Yeah.
They would be detected the same way they are in Central America. Basically, this is kidney disease of non-traditional origin. So in the absence of hypertension or diabetes, it's an unknown cause, essentially. A polycystic kidney is another one. But basically, you're dealing with a condition which has an unknown etiology. The chances are that a lot of that occurs in the U.S., if it's being diagnosed, because it's a lot of the labor that might be exposed would be migrant labor. So healthcare for that is more difficult to track. But if it's occurring here, it may well be occurring in ways where it's misattributed to hypertension or diabetes, because a lot of that might be by self-report rather than by documented biological evaluation of the individuals. So we think it's likely to be out there, and we're actually begun talking with the Myron Clinics Network to try to find out whether we can look at certain populations, either in agriculture or construction.
We'll take one more over here, please.
That was great, and I appreciate it. I follow this from afar, this discussion over years and the problem. I was just following up the comments about chronic kidney disease in the U.S. I've been looking at the utilization of the estimated glomerular filtration rate as a diagnostic tool, and my concern is that it's that we're having a diagnostic bias in part because it's a more sensitive and more easy to use tool, and that applying it here, if we look over time at that versus doing 24-hour urines, et cetera, that we may have that as a
You can never eliminate that possibility that there's a diagnostic bias that's occurring in this. We're not at all convinced of that in this environment.
No, not there.
Yeah. And we're not seeing, there isn't a CKD of non-traditional origin epidemic in the U.S. We think there might be, but we're not seeing it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Barry.